VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello, I'm Gav Marcotti. Welcome to The Game. And can I please start by saying I've spoken to the editor. I have his full confidence and my position is not at risk. I wish I could say the same about Rory K. Smith, who joins me today, along with Tony Cascarino and, of course, Ollie Kay. Later on, we'll be discussing Harry's Odyssey and looking at England's third-best team, West Bromwich Albion. Or are they? We'll also review the big money clash between Manchester City and Chelsea. In fact, let's do that straight away. Ollie, Rafa, booed. I think we have to start with that because it happened before the game. Now, I watched this game on television, and it was interesting because when Sky Sports News had the cameras out there when Rafa was appointed, you know, the guy made like a big song and dance about the fact, oh, I can't find a single Chelsea fan who'll say anything nice about Rafa. And, you know, he's doing his silly vox pops. This time I saw the package before, and funnily enough, they did find, I guess they had like a couple days to do it, they found a bunch of individuals portraying Chelsea fans who talked about, well, the change had to be made and, well, Rafa's got a good record and so on. Were you surprised by the reaction that was so vehement?
Well, I was disappointed. I don't think I would say I was surprised. I think this is the way people are now. They convince themselves that something is bad and they want to vent their displeasure before they've even given it a chance. I think Matt Dickinson made a very pertinent comparison in this morning times about George Graham when he took over at Spurs. At the time he had an Arsenal crest built into his patio, and yet he got mild booze from a few people and was then sort of generally ignored for the next year, whereas Benitez, you know, it just seems like people are so much more rabid now and more make their rabid feelings known in a very rabid manner, not just at Chelsea but elsewhere. But that is a very, very difficult environment for any manager and therefore any team to function.
Cass, I don't know if I fully agree with Ollie when he added the word now in there. I remember years ago when George Graham, in fact, the lovable George Graham, was linked to Chelsea. I remember sort of entire stadium singing, "You can stick George Graham up your arse." Mm. Now, that was pre-Abramovich and pre-Abramovich's money and things like that. Is there something wrong with disliking somebody because of your history, because of your... I mean, leave aside whether... I don't want to get into whether he's a good manager, he's the right man for the job. We'll have plenty of time to talk about that. But, I mean, they obviously weren't booing because they thought Rafa Benitez is a bad manager for Chelsea. They were booing because they simply don't like the guy because of his past. And I'm wondering... And they've made these feelings known before, when he was linked to the job before. Should the owner have maybe taken that into account, that ultimately he is selling a product, and if his customers don't like part of that product, that...
Well, it's a problem that he probably didn't think about, and, you know, association with a leading club, a successful club, like George Graham had when he was with Arsenal, you have rivals, there's rivalry in football, and obviously Tottenham and Chelsea and Liverpool and Man United, and, you know, some management posts are very difficult to appease the fans. It's very difficult.
It's not about appeasing the fans, it's about we tell you, we don't like this guy, and then you bring him here to manage. I mean, that's all I'm saying. It's like, from a, you're an owner, you're selling a product, should you take that into account.
Well, okay. Yeah, well, you should do, yeah, because you might find if it backfires that people might not readily want to come to the stadium and watch the games and make their feelings. It can make it a very... I was at the Bridge yesterday and it was a strange atmosphere for a new manager to walk into and feel that he's not wanted straight away. And Alex McLeish was at the first game he did for Villa and it was exactly the same. Maybe even more with the Villa fans, how they felt towards McLeish. It's difficult to... I think it's a very negative way of for the, everybody involved. For him to succeed, what will he really have to do? And even winning all the games, I mean, Chelsea fans have said many different reasons why they don't like him, not just because of the feeling of Liverpool and the rivalry between the two clubs when they were both challenging, especially in clashes in Champions League, but the feeling towards him, he wasn't, he's not, there was no warmth to even a manager. I think it's, you're going to get that when other big clubs, you get one of their managers and they've had success somewhere else. It just doesn't seem the feeling is wanted.
You say that, but I mean, I'm just imagining here, right? Arsene Wenger has been a rival of Chelsea's for a long time. Mm. Now, if he were to magically walk up at Stamford Bridge, I don't imagine he would get the reaction that Rafa got.
Well, the slight difference is the brand of football that a lot of Chelsea fans might feel that, yes, we'd love to have an adventurous style manager. I think you can slightly give a bit more leeway. But that would count for nothing, Gab, if results went the wrong way. I mean, you've got fans at Arsenal criticising Wenger at the moment and the booing of the substitutions.
Well, of course, yeah.
So, you know...
Is the more apt parallel not with what would happen if Wenger turned up at Man United, if Ferdy quits and Wenger is appointed as replacement? There's been a lot of really bad blood between United fans and Wenger, but they'd probably welcome him, I would guess, as Wenger's had proven success, maybe not the last 7 years, but he's won the title.
Well, it's funny because on that point, though, sometimes you just get that. I think it's part of the reason we love it. I mean, I remember when we were talking to our boss, Tony Evans, who I don't think I'm revealing any secrets here, has a slight affection for Liverpool. And from a few years ago, we were discussing possible future Liverpool managers. And, you know, I foolishly said, well, Mark Hughes is doing well and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it was like I told him, like, you know, you were going to get some weird disease to your genitals. You know, he's just like, no, you could never have Mark Hughes, blah, blah, because of it. Now, this is obviously Hughes, former United player. Now, it would be like if Gary Neville became head of PR at Liverpool, right? I mean...
He couldn't do worse than the last guy. Yeah, I mean, with Hughes, Christian Perslow approached Hughes when he was at City, I think. Christian Perslow met Hughes in Lisbon, and that Liverpool fans found out. And Mark Hughes' CV, which encompasses Manchester United, Chelsea, and Everton, amazing. They weren't sort of delighted about that prospect. And I'm sure that if Mark Hughes had been appointed Liverpool manager, they would have booed.
Is this a bad thing, though?
There is a different. Well, it's not. Fans have a right to have an opinion, and they have a right to express that opinion. The other excellent point that Dicko makes in the paper today is that a lot of what they're blaming Benitez for isn't Benitez's fault. Some of it's wrong. There's this, like, they've conflated the idea that they don't like him, so he is a bad manager. That's not true. That you do not like him, and he can be a bad manager, but one doesn't necessarily lead to the other. But the other thing is that all Benitez has done is answer a phone call to take a vacancy. He'd be a moron not to take the Chelsea job. He's been out of work for 2 years. The man they need to be angry with is Abramovich, who's completely ignored their faults.
Well, we'll get to from one time. Just quickly on Benitez, because you've worked with him. You know him. I know him a little bit too, and I've spoken to people, and everybody I've spoken to says that if there's one guy who's not going to be affected at all just because he's so monomaniacal about his work, it's Rafa Benitez. By the same token, though, there's another school of thought that says if there's one guy who wakes up early in the morning and reads all the newspapers to see what people are writing about him, it's Rafa Benitez.
Yeah, and funny if I
think... So which Rafa is it going
to
be?
The media's been relatively kind towards him, I think. So far, it's the fans that seem to really dislike him. A lot of the papers have said that, you know, he's handled it as well as he can. He's been relatively diplomatic. I mean, there's no point in me pretending I'm not. I would like Rafa to succeed as I like him as a bloke.
Not because you want Chelsea to succeed.
Well, I'm completely neutral towards Chelsea, as you know, Gab. But no, I want Rafa to do well because he's a nice fella. I think the structure at Chelsea probably works for him because he knows there's no one to fight against because you're not going to beat Abramovich. The question is, if he, as Tony says, if you have that atmosphere, it does transmit to the team and it will prevent him succeeding.
Managers at Chelsea have been left in no doubt that Abramovich wants them to manage in a certain way, and I can't see Abramovich's way being Benitez's way. I can't see Abramovich's way of working being Benitez's way of working. So I think, you know, Benitez has had a few days where he's enjoyed telling Michael Amanalo his strategy on football, telling, you know, showing journalists, you know, exactly why zonal marking does work, getting Lucozade bottles out and doing it at the training ground, at the press conference, etc. He'll enjoy all that. He won't enjoy it when, after the first defeat, he's got, you know, he's having the same conversations with Emanalo or whoever, and you know, the feedback is, well, the boss doesn't like this. The boss doesn't want you to do it this way. The boss wants you to do it that way. I think it's almost doomed.
Now, it says Fernando Torres here on my script, because I guess we need to talk about it. I did write the script. I don't know what I was thinking when I wrote it, because does anybody have anything original to say about this guy and the whole notion that because he did well with Rafa Benitez? I mean, maybe they should hire one of the 27 people who worked with him at Atletico Madrid when he was doing really well, too.
You were
a top flight center forward. Did you... Can a manager flick a switch? Or did you never play as badly as Rafa did, as Fernando has been playing?
Well, I probably moving it forward...
Relative to your peak, I mean, no disrespect.
Probably moving it forward, Gab, is going to be the reaction from the fans now towards Torres for the next 2, 3, 4 months of his performances. I mean, he joined Chelsea at 26. He's just 28. He looks... We're all disappointed because we all saw such a good player at Liverpool. And that's been the biggest thing for me is, right, can you recapture what you were? And for 20 months, we've saw the odd glimpse and that's been it. And then it's gone back to disappointment. And I do get the feeling is the biggest thing I'm looking at now is what are the fans going to be like to him? Because we're all talking about Rafa and the own and the blame and that. There's a lot of Chelsea fans who have finally run out of patience with Torres.
Well, the fans have backed him from the start. Ollie, I want to get
That's changing, Gab. That is definitely changing.
I think Tass is right. I think they're losing patience to an extent with Torres.
Yeah. I think they understand that Torres is the reason that Falcao is not there and Torres is the reason that Drogba isn't there. Then you can kind of see why people might get annoyed. I mean, I certainly would have turned on him a lot sooner. And the fact that this is also the gentleman who... immediately after they won the Champions League, what does he do in the mix zone in Munich? Ollie, you were there. He calls the media over to tell them how unhappy he is at the club and things had better change. But anyway, Ollie, I want to get you on this because I read this good stat, which comes from a journalist at another newspaper, but he is one of my favorites. Yes, Mr. Neil Ashton, who came up with this number, which apparently... Chelsea's management had pointed out to Abramovich before that I think it was 69% of Torres' goals at Liverpool came on sort of through balls from deep. And if you look at the fact that he had Gerrard and Xabi Alonso feeding him, those are two pretty good passers from deep. Now, unless Chelsea want to put Oscar in front of the back four and sort of fast forward into the future, they don't have anybody who can do that. There's nobody. You wouldn't say that's Mikel's strength or Ramirez's strength or Lampard's strength, indeed. Is that a problem? Is that the kind of sort of obvious sort of duh moment that, you know, maybe football clubs should pick up on?
Well, I remember having that conversation with Tony Barrett, almost the day of the transfer, we were saying Chelsea had not set up at all to play to Torres' strength, and I think Tony might ended up with writing something on those grounds. And it, I mean, I like the point you made about Oscar. I completely agree. I think he's a player who will ultimately be better in a deeper position. I also think that Mata is a player who is better in a central role behind the striker and pushed out wide to accommodate Oscar. So maybe there are things that they can move around there. But in terms of Torres and Liverpool, he scored an extraordinary variety of goals. He wasn't just chasing on for through balls. It was sometimes he would be near the touchline, he'd slalom through three players and, you know, stroke the ball in the far corner. He barely missed a chance, but at Chelsea he's barely even having a chance, and when he does he's invariably missing. So I'm starting to look at it now as a situation where, you know, Torres doesn't look like he's worth the indulgence. It doesn't look like it's worth Torres being a consideration in a managerial appointment, because Torres, Benitez was saying yesterday, we all need to help Fernando. Well, Fernando needs to help himself. But it seems, it seems like there might be something more underlying with the whole thing. I mean, I know that Matt saying it a few weeks ago on here that he looks like a depressed footballer with a small D. And he looks like the spark's gone completely. And you talk about flicking a switch. Well, you know, you can flick a switch, but it doesn't mean the thing will come on, does it?
Roy, going back to the actual game, obviously you get a point at home against the champions, who are top of the table. Main thing is, I don't think it's a bad point for Rafa, because you know, you kind of sort of break through that. Now you've got to, I think, can we call them minor London derbies? Well, Fulham, yes. West Ham, there is a bit of a spicy rivalry there. Those are Chelsea's next two games. Starting with Fulham, he's got to get 3 points. Otherwise, he doesn't have much of a margin of error as far as the support is concerned.
He doesn't have any margin of error at all. I wondered whether he needed 3 wins. I think 2 wins and a draw would probably do it to quell the rancor in the stands a little bit. I don't think he'll ever win Chelsea's fans over at all. I don't think that will happen. But yeah, 2 wins in the next 2 games would really help. Rafa's done what the first Tony and I were talking about this before. The first thing Rafa will do when he goes into any club is make the defence work. It's not a coincidence that Chelsea kept a clean sheet yesterday. That's not a coincidence. That's what Rafa's main concern would have been stop shipping goals, build from there. Fulham are a good side going forward, lovely to watch, but they're vulnerable. You can score goals against Fulham. West Ham,
even Torres.
Maybe Torres, probably not. You probably don't need him to score goals if you don't matter and Hazard. And I think Ollie's right. I think play Oster deep, that might help. Push Ramirez out wide right, that might help as well. I think Mikel's actually had quite a good season for Chelsea. He looks improved substantially, John Obi Mikel. But yeah, Rafa does not have a margin for error. Just on Torres, I think to me the way that this looks is this is Abramovich's final gamble. If Benitez can't get Torres scoring, then I think Abramovich is probably prepared to write Torres off. But he wants to do everything to give him that chance. And if Benitez, whatever happens to Benitez in terms of staying for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 6 months, 7 months, 10 years, if Torres isn't scoring at the end of the season, I think they enact their contract with Falcao, and then Torres, God knows what happens to him, but Torres goes. That's the way this looks to me.
West Brom are up to third in the table, and I want to throw this out there to Ollie and throw my theory out there, is that I'm not 100% on board with why or how they're third in the table. Now, I know there's people talk about the analytics revolution and Moneyball. Regular listeners will know that I'm skeptical about big chunks of that. But you look at West Brom, I think they have the fourth lowest possession percentage in the league. And then you say, aha, but that's because they're a great counterattacking side. Well, no, they've only scored 2 goals all season from counterattacks. Haven't scored a lot of goals from set pieces either. They don't make a lot of short passes. They don't make a lot of long passes. They're the last in the league in terms of crosses. I look at the numbers here, and there's no real explanation why West Brom should be third, apart from the fact that they managed to score a lot of goals from open play, and evidently they're a good side. And maybe one clue is they tend to score first in games, which obviously when you score first, things get easier. But it was suggested to me that maybe West Brom have actually been kind of lucky this season. And I know it's anathema to say that. Am I way off base there, Ollie? And not just, I think it's obvious they were very fortunate against Sunderland, but I mean, but is that a crazy and disrespectful thing to say?
I think it's fair enough to say that they're not outstanding in anything that would come up in the numbers. I think they are, their strength is that they are an intelligent, disciplined, organised team, and they do attack in an intelligent way. And you know, they generally would keep sort of 7 men behind the ball and attack very well with 4. And it's a very, it doesn't sound like rocket science, but it's amazing how few teams there are in the Premier League who are defending well and defending in a disciplined manner and attacking efficiently. It's in terms of teams who've got that balance not too many spring to mind, really. They've got some very good players. I think Malumbu is one of the most underrated players in the Premier League. Jacob has really impressed me. You know, he's somebody I haven't seen much of previously, to put it mildly. And their attacking players are good. They're strong, quick, powerful. And they've got, you know, people like Brunt and Morrison, who are, you know, nobody's ideas of a Premier League star. You know, they are really decent players who are capable of doing a job every week and doing it well. And I think Clark has moved them on from what they were under Hodgson. And I think Hodgson did a good job there. Everybody would agree with that. But they just look better. They look more intelligent. I don't think they'll be in the top four or five at the top of the season, at the end of the season. But they don't look like a team that's particularly going to run out of energy at the moment. They're very impressive.
I think I'd want to take issue with one thing Ollie said. I think that, apart from Jakob, who else have they signed since?
Compared to last season.
No, compared to last season.
Generally, it's
the same squad.
Lukaku's been very good.
Yeah, Lukaku's done okay. Missed sort of a little bit sort of,
well, he hasn't,
unclinical in front of goal, yeah, shall we say.
And it's not as if Lukaku started every game.
No, but basically it's the same side. So was Hodgson holding them back?
No, I mean, I think if you look at the last few years, I think they've operated exceptionally well in the transfer window. I mean, Gareth McCauley, I remember when they signed him, I'm like, who the hell is this guy? I'm like, oh, he must be a promising young Irish type. And then I realized that, no, he's actually, and I'm sorry, I don't follow the championship, okay, so shoot me now. I know he'd be, oh, he's captain of Ipswich, all right, who cares, Ipswich. But I found out that this guy was a window fitter until he was like 25 years old. And then he goes to Lincoln, and yeah, I did read up on him, and Ipswich, and they sign him on a free transfer, and you think, like, this guy doesn't have a single minute of Premier League experience. He was doing a different job until a few years ago. And he slots in there alongside Olsen, who's another one who, you know, people in Sweden, Olsen was kind of written off a few years ago, you know. And they've been very effective, also because they've got this tremendous bunker in front of them of Jakob and Malumbu. You look at Ben Foster, who I think, as far as English goalkeepers go this season, I know Hart's had a horrible year. I would still take Hart over him. But I can't think of another Englishman who's any good as a goalkeeper, or good enough, or who's better than Foster at this stage. And you look at these pieces together, Peter Onenvinge, a couple million pounds, and I'm asking myself, is this just kind of like this, not good fortune, but this sort of things that, this idea that things are going their way. Is it not some kind of cosmic reward for the fact that they have all their ducks in the row? They've been a wonderful, wonderfully run club for a few years, and they deservedly finish mid-table the last 2 years, and this season they'll probably deservedly finish, you know, top eight maybe, or maybe higher.
Well, I think if you look at clubs that have achieved similar feats, and, you know, Charlton Athletic under Alan Kirbishley done amazing things. You know, everyone fighting for their shirt.
Who?
Alan Kirbishley, Charlton.
Bolton under Allardyce.
Yeah, finished, you know. I'm sorry, guys. Why are we drawing a comparison between these teams?
No, we're talking
Kirbishley
about
a decade ago. And like,
no,
you know.
Because I played for a club at Millwall in the late 80s that we were third up until March. And we were a bunch of what you decide, some window guys and whatever. I came out of non-league. We had a few other guys, and guys you'd never heard of because they played lower league football, came into the team. But what we had was a unity within the group that everybody fought for each other. And I think West Brom have got that with some talent. And, you know, people like Shane Long. Shane Long couldn't get in the Reading side 4 or 5 years ago. He was in and out of the team. He was offloan here and there.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Now he looks a really good striker in the Premiership, but they've
Why doesn't it show up in the stats? Is it that we're kind of stupid when we talk about the analytics revolution?
But the one stat you've left out that they've
points.
Actually,
yeah, I know. It's the one stat that matters.
Yeah,
but,
and they're not conceding a shipload of goals. They're at home. They've been a very good side. If you talk about all the teams about being lucky, I don't really think you can say, apart from the first 30 minutes against Liverpool, which they eventually won 3-0, where they survived a lot of chances by Liverpool that they missed. West Brom have really, for me, dominated most of the home games they've played.
Well, I would suggest
one thing there, right? I think they had the bulk of the possession twice this season against their opposition. And to me, it's a bit unusual because they have actually a lot of guys who are good on the ball. Mm. What doesn't add up to me is if you don't concede and you tend to score first, as West Brom do, wouldn't you then want to keep the ball as a defensive tactic, look to hit on the break since you've got a very fast striker in Odovigny? You see what I'm saying? Like, it just doesn't quite
add up. What my friends in the analytics business would say is that if the numbers don't show you why they're doing well, then you're not looking at the right numbers.
Okay, but your friends, if I may say so, are perhaps just kind of like morons who just kind of look for numbers that kind of prove what's already happened, regardless of what.
I mean, this is a bigger subject.
It's one thing to say that yeah, you're possibly not looking at the right numbers, or maybe they will just regress to the mean, right?
Yeah, well, I suspect West Brom will regress to the mean. I think there's no question about that. They will. They won't. No offense to West Brom, they won't finish third. I don't think anyone's expecting them to finish third. They will regress to the mean because that's what happens. But that just because they don't have the most possession, or they don't score from counter attacks, or they don't have the most corners, or whatever, doesn't mean you're looking at the right numbers. If the numbers don't say it, there will be a reason for it. No, I don't know what that is.
And it can't simply be probability and happenstance. Yeah.
Luck plays a massive part.
No,
luck will
luck,
play a
I
huge
mean,
part, or circumstance, or whatever you want to call it, sort of serendipity.
I mean, you mentioned those games. I mean, unlike you, I haven't watched every single one of West Brom's games this season, but I did see them against Liverpool, against Chelsea. Mm-hmm. I think they could have lost those games, and I think they could have easily lost this game against Sunderland. Now, you can say that... it's not luck, but you know, when Mignolet makes two mistakes on two shots, when Liam Ridgewell, I'm not going to go and crucify Ridgewell and say he dived and he's a cheat, whatever, but I think it's pretty obvious he wasn't touched. I think he actually just kind of stopped all of a sudden, anticipating the tackle, and just kind of lost his balance and fell over, but whatever, that should have never been a penalty. And then they score a fourth goal that's kind of a counterattack. As you know, I'm not a huge Martin O'Neill fan, but I think if I'm O'Neill, I say, hey, gee, I kind of got jobbed in that game. You put those three wins together, that's 9 points that they have, which they could just as easily not have, and then we wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation.
If you look at the West Brom-Chelsea game, I mean, I'm sure, I mean, going back to the stats issue, I mean, stats don't measure things like organisation, concentration at set pieces, winning the headers that really matter, winning the battles all over the pitch, and you know, performing with an intelligence and a determination that maybe more gifted opponents don't. And I think that's what West Brom have done generally. I'm not sort of calling them a plucky underdog team who are scrapping for everything, but they are playing intelligently, and they are supplementing that by being a good team that doesn't give much away, that attacks in an intelligent manner. And you know, I think these are the things that perhaps don't show up in stats, because I'm sure there are many players whose great virtues wouldn't particularly show up well in stats. I would think Shane Long is probably one of them, because he's very good at hold-up play, he's very good at running the channels, he's very good at laying the ball off simply and then perhaps doing nothing else for 10 minutes. But I think West Brom have got a really good balance, and although we can say they've got 9 points that they could just as easily not have got, I'm sure there will have been moments in the games where they did drop points where they could just as easily have picked points up.
A flip side of this is that if you're Martin O'Neill, you can feel annoyed this season that you didn't get points. And I think there were other games this year where maybe they felt they should have had more. I'm thinking of the Everton game as well. I think I have this as 2 wins in 18. Rory Smith, who dislikes O'Neill intensely, evidently, says it's 2 wins in 20. That is what you said, Roy, yes? 2 wins in 20?
I think it's 2 wins in 20 or something like that, yeah.
Why not 2 wins in 50? But whatever the case, a lot of draws, not many wins. They've been riding Stephen Fletcher bandwagon. I think the last couple of games they've tried to attack more. Hasn't fully worked out. He's got nothing to worry about. Has he?
Well, if they keep on not winning games, he does, yeah, to be honest. I thought it was weird. I can't remember which. I think it was after the Weir Tyne derby. He said that his creative players weren't working well enough, as though it was their fault. And you sort of think, well, that's your job as the manager to get that out, to put them in a system where they can flourish. Mm. I don't know, the Sunderland are kind of a nothing team to me. I really like Fletcher. I think Fletcher's a brilliant footballer. But there's just, they are not a very good side.
We can't end it on this note of total negativity with him calling Sunderland a nothing team and having a go at O'Neill. Will you stick up for your fellow Irishman?
No.
Okay, no, okay.
No, I tell you for one reason. I'm sorry, but we're going to look at a manager that up until the Everton game, only one player had scored in the first 10 games of the season. One player in his team has managed to get a goal. You talked about stats earlier. Well, that stat is ridiculous because any team organised well enough will find goal scorers, whether it's a centre-half, full-back, midfield or centre-forward. You should, as a manager, be productive in making your team score goals. And for me, that was the biggest criticism I could say.
Ollie, it seems like nobody in the studio has something nice to say about Martin O'Neill and Sunderland. I will be forced to do it unless you do it. So please help me out.
Well, I think if you look at the stats, as we're so keen to do, as you say, Gab, that they have played in a more attacking manner the past few weeks. They have seemed to be devoting more time to trying to create chances and so on. I'm just really surprised that they're as poor as they are this season, because I would have said a team that added a goal scorer such as Fletcher, a team that added a sort of tricky two-dimensional, three-dimensional wide player like Adam Johnson would do well given what Sunderland had already, which was a sort of tight, compact, organised team. And I'm surprised that they've been so poor, because there doesn't seem to be any real reason for it. You would think they would be a better team than West Brom, but on the evidence so far, they're nothing like it.
All right, in our debate this week, Queen's Park Rangers have a new manager. Now, we had to go through this sort of charade whereby he was going to pretend to go to the Ukraine, and he got all his buddies involved on television, all this. I'm told, I understand that the Ukrainians are going to pay him $10 billion a year, and Harry's very popular in Ukraine and blah, blah, blah. Now, I'm assuming nobody really bought any of that. Anybody believe for 1 minute that he was going to become the Ukraine manager, or that Paul Stretford had even been to the Ukraine?
I don't know if I want to allege that Paul Stretford did not go to the Ukraine, but I think
he may have gone to the Ukraine.
Yeah, I don't think Harry Redknapp ever had any intention of becoming a Ukraine manager, no.
Okay.
The weird thing about it was that the news was leaked by the Ukrainian FA on their website, so that would dilute my skepticism very slightly.
Yes, because it's very normal for an FA to reveal on their website who they're having talks with, right?
Well, I'm not in the...
I remember that I going to the FA.com and seeing that press release and saying, ha-ha, everybody thinks it's going to be Harry Redknapp to replace Fabio, but no, we're secretly having talks with Roy Hodgson, tee-hee. You remember that, Ollie?
Well, they didn't mention Redknapp, but they did put up a statement on that Sunday night saying we are now in talks with Roy Hodgson and we hope to make an appointment. So it's I don't think Harry Redknapp was ever going to go there. I believe that conversations were had and that in that much at least it was genuine.
QPR bottom of the table, I think much has been made. Redknapp's a very popular guy. He's people, you know, with this, he's developed this Harry Houdini sort of persona because he took over two teams that were in the bottom three and kept them up, although, to be fair, one of them were Spurs, who I don't think anybody, even the most negative Ned out there, would think that Spurs were going to go down that season. I'm looking at Skinner, who's Mr. Negative, and he's shaking his head, and a Spurs fan. But the other one was Southampton, where, of course, he spent a lot of money and it didn't work out. But he's going to keep QPR up, right? Anybody have any doubt whatsoever about that?
No, I think he'll...
No, so you agree he's definitely going to keep them up?
No, I think he'll do what he always does. He'll go into the market, he'll buy players that he thinks will do him a job, and Harry is a manager that goes to try and win games. I think there's any doubt that he sets his team up adventurous and looks to get 3 points more often than not.
But if you're going to do that, why not do it with these players? Because, I mean, they're good players.
But Harry's never done that. Harry's always brought in his own personal choices. People that he thinks, I'm sure we're walking, and I'm thinking that one of the first things he'd have said to Fernandez, Tony Fernandez, is that I will want this, comes at a cost. Because he's always gone, and he's never gone to a club and not changed personnel.
At the same time, they can't be spending another sort of 50 million in the hope of staying up. I think it would be madness, because they have got good players who have so far not been playing for each other, and I think in some cases you sort of need the heads banging together to start giving something to the cause.
I think they need a striker, don't they? If you look at, I mean, Zamora and Johnson are injured. Bobby Zamora doesn't look like he fancies football anymore. Andy Johnson, you can't really rely on him to be fit. He's never fit. So I wouldn't be surprised if Harry goes out and signs a striker, which will be Jermaine Defoe or Peter Crouch, so that's who he always signs. That would be understandable. They need a centre-back, because Anton Ferdinand is dreadful, and that would make sense to me. But I think
not a big Clint Hill fan, then?
Clint Hill is decent.
Stefan Mbia, who thought he was signing for Glasgow Rangers?
I quite like Mbia. He's not a bad player. Clint Hill...
You have Ryan Nelson,
limited.
Very good.
Nelson's okay. Nelson's okay. But I think the bigger issue with QPR is not the manager. I mean, I don't think anyone can really argue that Hughes had to go, because it had been poor. I think Hughes is a decent manager, but they'd been poor. Harry's a sensible appointment, as Cass says. He'll keep them up. The question is Tony Fernandez's reign. You look at the way that they've bought players is ridiculous. They spent loads in January. They go out and buy players in two tranches in the summer, putting them, not massive fees, but ridiculous wages for a club of 18, whose average date is 18,000. They then,
by the way, that's not really their fault. They can't. I mean, the stadiums are only.
No. But you spend to an extent. That has to be a consideration of how much you spent. Julio Cesar's on £96,000 a week. Nedimanu is on £46,000 a week. It's irresponsible. But the other thing is, Fernandez has fallen for Harry Redknapp's sort of Ukraine trick. This is a successful businessman. Why is he being such a moron? I think that really, I mean, that worries me. I like QPR as a club, but they're good to deal with.
Yeah.
They've got some great, I mean, good players. I like Fowling as a player, I like Granero as a player, I like Diakite as a player. They've got good footballers there. But Tony Fernandez has to look at his ownership model, because it's ridiculous.
There's been so many people in football like that. They come in as successful businessmen and they'll make really bad decisions. I just can't see, and I know Ollie said that, you know, working with the group that they've already got, I just can't see Harry not introducing new faces. He's always gone about his business. And by the way, we're talking about players who've been bad. Jisan Park has been unbelievably bad for them. He's come from Manchester United. You know, okay, they've only paid two and a bit million for him, but his performances for me were unrecognisable. I mean, I know he's always been a hard-working, you know, pretty average squad player at Man United, but his performances at QPR have been anything but that.
What about Nedimanu, though?
Yeah,
Nedimanu has GCSEs, let's all remember that.
Yeah, but it just seems to me that because of that, I mean, it seems like there was a period this season that, because of Anton Ferdinand and the John Terry case, and because of Nedimanu and the fool with the iPad, people were kind of giving these guys a pass and saying, like, oh, it's a good idea, let's pay them a lot of money. But I think they've been terrible. And the fact that he used to play Clint Hill, who, you know, for all the love in the world, is a limited player, and Ryan Nelson, who's the size of a house and 35 years old, and they perform better than, you know, these other guys who've obviously had injuries and whatever. I think that tells a lot about some of the...
Anu is kind of okay. He's kind of... He's all right, Nedimanu. He's not brilliant. He's not a £50,000 a week player. He's a squad player. But that's the other thing with QPR and Hughes particularly. Kia Jarabshian. Now, I've been told that Kier Jarpin is in no way an agent and does not represent players and does not do deals for QPR.
He's an advisor.
There's no question that he has been involved with QPR's transfer policy. Name me a club where Kier Jarpin has been an advisor on transfer policy that has had any long-term success. He won a title with Corinthians, gets them relegated. Gets in at West Ham, gets them relegated. Gets huge kicks out of City, gets huge kicks out of QPR. Why do people keep employing him?
Well, City won the title a year later, and I think you'll find that.
When Jarpin was persona non grata at City?
No, but Carlos Tevez was still there.
No, they really would have because of Tevez, didn't they?
Thank you, Ollie.
Okay, I was sorry, Kia. I tried there. Even I can't staunch the negativity from these rabid dogs here.
This is a different form of criticism. I'm not the normal.
But
criticism
can I ask you a question though about this?
Can I just finish my point? I'm not criticizing Kia because he's bad for football or whatever.
No, that's
irrelevant.
He's just made bad choices.
I think he's not very good at his job.
If Kia hypothetically were a director of football, this would have been grounds for sacking him along with Mark Hughes.
Yeah, exactly.
Here's my thing about Hughes is, I think Mark Hughes has a lot to give in terms of management. I think he made some horrible mistakes at QPR. But I can think of one manager who absolutely stunk up the joint in his first job and in his second job and in his third job in one decent season. Then he got relegated the following year. And that manager went on to win two Liga titles, a UEFA Cup and a Champions League. And that manager, of course, is
Rafael Benitez.
There you go. We learned from our mistakes. All right, time now for some quick hits. Liverpool are held 1-0 draw at Swansea. Rory, should Rodgers be happy? And should Jose Enrique's goal have stood?
Brendan Rodgers should be happy, yes indeed, because it's a good point. Liverpool are unbeaten in, I think, 8 now or something. They look solid, they're not conceding goals. It's something to build on, and they've got a relatively kindly December. Get through Spurs away on Wednesday, and I think the season might take a little bit of a pick-up.
Bonus question, very quick answer. Now, if you were a Liverpool fan, which you are, would you swap Brendan for Rafa?
No comment.
Yeah, you really won't answer that question. I think it's hilarious. I suspect Tony Evans probably would. Manchester United beat QPR 3-1, but they've now fallen behind in 9 of 13 Premier League games. Ollie, this can't be part of Sir Alex's master plan, can it? Feign weakness by going a goal down and then coming back and obliterating the opposition? What's wrong?
Well, it's clearly not part of the plan, but I think it's probably part of opposition managers' plan to attack what is a very relatively vulnerable Man United team. I think teams can get at them in the early stages, and then over the course of the game, I think things generally return to normal, and United get a hold in the game and score goals. But I just don't think this is a very good United team. They'll probably finish with 90 odd points again, but I think that's more reflection of the league than on United.
Hey, how does Tottenham Hotspur question get in here? Was it you, Skinner? Spurs batter West Ham 3-1, and your old pal Jermaine Defoe scores 2 and looks like a miniature Marco van Basten. Cass, are you on board with AVB now?
I think Van Basten's a bit of an exaggeration, but he's taking every chance he's getting at the moment. Looking sharp, AVB is, I think he's fortunate to have the type of players that the way he wants to play, pace out wide, players that can get past. See, very few wingers now who can deliver and give chances like to Defoe and be creative. But one thing I did read on Defoe the weekend, he wants to do I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here after his playing days, which I thought was quite strange.
Perfect. I assume that show will be cancelled by the time he retires, unless it's next week. But hey, who knows? Arsenal draw 0-0 at Villa. Wenger gets booed for replacing Olivier Giroud with Francis Coquelin, which incenses our colleague Pete Lansley with very angry words in the paper today. Rory, the Gunners have a massive new kit and stadium deal, and Ivan Gazidis says there's money to spend. Will Wenger spend it, and how should he spend it?
Wenger will not spend it. No, he'll no doubt buy a couple more players, but he won't get anywhere near to spending that £150 million because he doesn't like it. How should he spend it? He should spend it on a team. The problem with Arsenal is they've got lots of quite good players, but no one really outstanding apart from Cazorla. They look very sort of, they're decent, Arsenal. So I don't know, the problem is, I guess, you've got to upgrade so many players that you probably would need to spend £150 million to improve that side.
Or just sign a bunch of Uruguayans. You'd be good with that, right?
You could sign a lot of Uruguayans. That would work.
All four Spanish teams are through to the knockout stage of the Champions League. All three Bundesliga teams are leading their groups. Meanwhile, City are out, and barring an act of God, Chelsea are on their bike too. Ollie, is there a reason for the Premier League to be worried about its hegemony, real or imagined?
I would expect expected that the Premier League and individual clubs would have been worried about that for the past 3 years. I've been banging the drum for 3 years saying this Premier League is not as strong as it was, or at least the very top teams aren't as strong as they were between 2006 and 2009, where they dominated the Champions League without winning it too many times. But they you look at the stats, you look at the results, English teams are not the force that they were in Europe in the previous few seasons, and it's blindingly obvious. Most of them look like they're in transition, and City are probably the one outstanding team, yet they're struggling because they're in tough groups.
I should tell you that Rory rolled his eyes while you were speaking, but don't worry, I'll deal with him later. Nigel Atkins was supposed to be going the way of Mark Hughes. Now Southampton have won two in a row. Cass, tell me why the Saints are going to be all right.
Well, their goalkeeper stopped making individual mistakes and giving the other teams the lead for a start. I mean, look, they were very unfortunate against Man United. The way they played against them at St Mary's would have given a lot of hope for Nigel Atkins. And then they go away and have a great performance at Queen's Park Rangers and followed up by playing an injury-plagued Newcastle. And a bit of confidence has shown, because the way they played yesterday tells me the team is obviously starting to believe now that they got a chance. And Nigel Atkins has to take a lot of credit for that.
Plus, as Rory's about to tell you, Gaston Ramirez is about to live up to the hype.
Oh, he's going to explode onto the South Coast. Gab, one for you. I know all four Spanish clubs have advanced in the Champions League.
Yes, because did you just
ask Ollie about it? And apparently all three Bundesliga teams are leading their groups. But I'm not fooled about La Liga. It's still a two-horse race, isn't it?
Yes, it is a two-horse race, but it's not the two horses most of our listeners might be thinking of, Rory. As you well know, Atletico Madrid are having an absolute storm. Real Madrid now 11 points back after their defeat at Betis, but Atletico are just 3 points behind Barcelona. Might I add, this is the Barcelona team that have made the best ever start to a La Liga season. So I think it's a credit to Diego Simeone. It's not just all about Radamel Falcao and Arda Turan up front. I think defensively they've been fantastic. I'm a huge fan of Simeone, and now that David Beckham likes him as well, I think we can all get behind Simeone, and as neutrals in the holy war between Real and Barca, all cheer on Los Colchoneros. Yes, we're all Atletico fans here, right?
Yeah, you gotta be.
Damn straight. I'm sure they've got some. They have a Uruguayan player. There you go, so you love them too. Yeah. That's all we've got time for this week. It's been fun. Come find us on Twitter to share your thoughts, or you can email, as many of you do every week, gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. You can go to thetimes.co.uk. You'll find your news, your analysis, your web chats, your blogs. We're all on Twitter, so you can... Are you still a Twitter cast?
No.
No, you've abandoned Twitter. Did they drive you out?
Too much abuse.
There you see.
From me to them.
Yes, Tony Cascarino, of course, one of those former pros who's been banned for sending abusive tweets. But Rory, Ollie, and myself are all on there. We'd love to hear from you. Hit us up. Till next time, bye-bye.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan, and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts, and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.